Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. My name is Andrew. I am coming to you from Victoria, British Columbia. We are joined, as always, by Michael, our resident ephesiologist. We have Matt.
Just a long pause there.
It's just excitement. It's just, here's our guy. He's with us. It's Michael.
Aww. You need to wonder.
But don't get lost in the wonder. Don't get lost in the wonder. We still have Matt. Matt joining us from Miami, Florida. And we have the distinct privilege today to be joined by Dr. Ralph Corner. Now, Dr. Corner joins us from Edmonton, Alberta, for those who are American and don't know where that is. It's in Canada. Dr. Corner received his PhD in 2014 from McMaster University. He has been a professor, an adjunct pastor, an adjunct instructor, and also pastored for 11 years at two different NAB churches in Edmonton. So, Dr. Corner, welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a distinct pleasure to be here with you all.
It's a nice thing. Now we have two of us in Canada, two of us in the United States, right? So we're a little more balanced on the podcast today. Beyond being Canadian, beyond being a pastor and a professor and all those wonderful things, Ralph, I'll call you Ralph if you're okay with that.
Sure.
What are some things that people in your life know to be true about you, like that are your friends? So How can we get to know the real Ralph?
All right. Well, you might not want to get to know the real Ralph.
Okay. Well, I'm trying. Let's go for it. Let's find out.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Well, time.
I'm married to only one wife, so that's probably a good thing. We're 42 years now. So God has been gracious.
Congrats.
Thank you. It's a joy. We have four adult children, and from them, four grandchildren, ages 5 down to 2, little boy and 3 girls. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday and said, you know, as grandparents, we should be able to just skip a generation and go straight to grandchildren. You know, there's so much fun. I said, yeah, you're pretty good, but yeah, grandchildren, they're the cherry on the top. So that's, you know, on the family side. It was some who is a Ralph kind of stuff. I am a soccer fanatic, so I've played, or football for those in European or other countries.
Yes.
So I've played that ever since 6 years old, and played at, you know, like sort of first division in Calgary and Edmonton. So I love soccer. I started as a center half. That was sort of my primary position. Then as I got older.
You were the ball handler distributor.
You bet. I love that. Yep.
Wow.
Okay.
This guy knows what he's talking about.
It's my bailiwick. So as I got older, then I went to sweeper. And as I got older, I went to goalkeeper. And as I got older, I went to goal posts. So I don't play anymore.
Whoa. He's now a lineman. That's great.
You know, the old knees, after a couple surges, like, yeah, time to hang up the cleats. So, but I still love soccer, follow it. I'm German in my ethnic background. So, of course, Germany's my national team, and Bayern Munich's my club team that I vote for. And so, yeah, just a little tidbit of who's Ralph, and aside from the scholarly and pastoral side.
I'm sporting the Inter Miami football club hat right now. So
hey, I didn't notice the pinkness in it. That now I see the pinkness in it.
Yeah.
There we go.
So yes. The stadium is in my backyard practically. So Messi plays pretty regularly. We don't get to as many games as we had hoped to. But Argentina was just in town. He was playing with them, and they moved that game from Chicago down here. And so, anyway, a lot of exciting things. They're building a big stadium though into Miami starting next year. But it's been a fun sport for us, for our family, even just to kind of get more engaged with as we've been down here in South Florida. So,
That's so cool, Matt. I was going to ask how things are on the bandwagon, but I will actually just leave that question for later. And Michael, why do we have the joy of having Ralph on the podcast today?
Well, I think it should be because we want to talk about football, maybe.
Yeah, actually, four happy people, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, you know what? I'm excited that Ralph succumbed to my arm twisting, although it should have been much earlier than this. I can't believe we're 211 episodes into this, and this is the first time that we've had him on. But I have grown to appreciate so much Ralph's scholarship, especially around the topic of the ecclesia. And he has two just outstanding volumes on the subject, rather pricey, and probably only read by, certainly not the casual reader of these sorts of volumes, but they are so well worth the price of the books, and they've been very beneficial for me and my thinking about what the church is and how ecclesia was expressed in those early centuries. So I'm excited to be able to have that conversation with him. But not only that, the thing that I remember about Ralph in our first meeting were two things. One is he was so kind and gracious to buy Ecclesiology and muddle his way through it. I could hardly believe it. And then secondly, he has a heart, a pastor's heart for scholars. And I just love that about him. He cares for those of us who are in the academy, and you can just hear that in his voice and in your interaction with him. And so for that reason, I'm happy that he's on here as well.
Thank you, Michael.
That's wonderful. Well, Michael, thank you for teeing that up. Ralph, you decided to write not one but two volumes on the ecclesia. That is a topic that we have gone round and round and round on, I feel, always making sure that we bring it up. We're talking about what that is. For the not as obsessed among us, in layman's terms, what is the ecclesia? And then how do you see the proper understanding actually help us look back and understand maybe what Jesus is talking about when he talks about it and what Paul is talking about when he talks about it?
Sure. Yeah, good question. Yeah, so the ecclesia obviously is a Greek word that we translate in the New Testament either as church or sometimes assembly, perhaps congregation, but usually as church. And so in the ancient world, that word ecclesia had a very particular meaning, depending on whether you're viewing it through the eyes of a Greek or Roman or through the eyes of a Jew. In its essence, the word ecclesia was the term used for when citizens in a city would gather on a regular basis to hear the recommendations that city councilors would bring to the citizens and for those citizens to vote upon those recommendations. So basically democracy, as it first appeared in Athens in the 6th century BC. And this was the regular forum that citizens gathered in. They argued their cases and then back and forth, and eventually would vote with little pebbles on which, you know, recommendations would go through. So in essence, the ecclesia gathering, you might say, was there to better the health of the city. So they're trying to find out how can we move our city forward, whether it's in terms of alliances we create with other cities, whether it's in terms of, you know, the food surpluses we need to create to make sure we're secure, whether it's laws for internal governance, you name it, the citizens all voted upon it. And so then you take that concept, and then you have a bunch of people in the first century going around calling themselves an ecclesia. And you can imagine what Greeks and Romans are thinking. What are you talking about? So, you know, one of my home church for the most of my time here in Edmonton was Northgate Baptist Church. So it's almost like we would rename ourselves Northgate Baptist City Hall. You know, that's sort of the shocking people go, what the heck? Are you trying to replace City Hall? No. We're here to come alongside City Hall and bless them in their endeavors. We, as God's people, see there's more to public life than economics and governance and social services. But we want to add the spiritual dimensions of health to this city as well. But we also want to work in the social and the economic and the political and all those dimensions to make the city become better and build community. In a big picture, that's, you might say, the essence from a Greek and Roman perspective.
Well, I know Matt's going to want to get back to that, but I'm going to hold him off just for a moment because
Michael knows me too well.
Because you just made the comment that we want to make sure that we're clarifying, because you seem to indicate that the ecclesia is in fact the people of God, but from what I understand from you, you are not by any stretch of the imagination a supersessionist. So help us navigate that nuance in the language and the understanding of the ecclesia, the people of God, the place of Israel, and all of this, and so on.
And while you're at it, define supersessionism for everybody listening who doesn't know what that is. Thank you.
I was going to say it too.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
Well, to tell you the truth, I had no idea what it meant when I first was introduced to that term. While I was doing dissertation research, one of the scholars came up to me and said, have you ever thought about the supersessionist implications of the word ecclesia? I said, the super what? is that a new race car or something? I have no idea what you're talking about. So in essence, supersessionism comes from the word supersede, which means to replace. And so at its, you might say, most extreme, supersessionism says that the ethnic identity Israel and the ethnic identity Jew has now been transferred to the followers of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah. And so now the true Israel is no longer, ethnic Israel has lost their identity as Israel. Christians now have the identity Israel. Jews no longer have the identity Jew. Christians have the identity Jew. And basically that then removes ethnic Israel outside of Christ from God's, you might say, salvation history at this point in time, that the church now has taken over that identity. And thus Jewishness has no value within a Christian context. And so we saw that right away in the second century with Ignatius, where he's a Neo-Pauline convert, and he refused to allow Christians to live in any way in a Jewish manner. And so even Jews who came to Christ had to relinquish their Jewishness. And Polycarp would say, to have Judaism and Christianity is monstrous. You can't do that. So that ends up resulting in anti-Judaism or the Christians that and anti-Semitism, so that where anything Jewish was no longer of value in the church. And in fact, we could actually say, well, God's done with the Jews, so we're done with the Jews. We can just persecute them. We can, disenfranchise them, marginalize them. And historically, the church has done that, unfortunately. So it has significant implications for how we live, social justice-wise. A quick comment. I don't want to keep talking too much, but when it comes to the word ecclesia, the beauty of that is how I talked, remember, about the Greek and Roman perspective. Well, from a Jewish perspective, the word ecclesia occurs in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible called the Septuagint. And it is used when they're describing the Israelites in the desert. They are named the ecclesia of the Lord. And so this Jewish national identity is ecclesia of the Lord. And what that means is that when Paul, for example, used ecclesia as a title for his groups of Christians, he was permanently seating them in a Jewish heritage as well. So he wasn't just making them relevant for Greeks and Romans going, oh, we got what you're trying to do, health of the city. He's making them relevant permanently with their Jewish heritage, saying, even if you become a fully Gentile congregation, you always will have a Jewish identity. And so Paul's valuing Jewishness eternally by naming his community's ecclesia in that sense. So, I mean, that's just one sliver of the supersessionist, post-supersessionist perspective, but I think an important one with respect to the title he gave his communities as ecclesia.
Well, I mean, it's neat in one sense when you, we're 2,000 years on this side of that history. Looking back at that, you can see how the hand of God was orchestrating things in a certain way. That language, it began to be common. The way that was expressed at a certain period of time was taking on some mutual understanding. And it became meaningful to not only the Jews, but the Greeks and others at that in the first century.
Yeah, and I think that's the beauty of Paul as a missiologist, right? He is looking at the cultures and saying, what is already in the cultures that can be bridges of communication for the gospel? And yeah. I mean, just what he named his communities was phenomenal, phenomenally culturally relevant and shocking. Yeah. People would have gone, whoa, what are you guys all about? Let me ask more questions. He builds curiosity, right? So I love that about Paul.
Okay, so let's turn Matt loose on this question, because I know he's thinking about, wait, ecclesia, the well-being of the city, what is all of that about?
Yeah, I this is a wonderful conversation already. Ralph, kind of speak to a little bit about this concept, and you've already been saying it, but like this is a word that already pre-existed in the time and in the culture, right? So one thing I'm thinking about here, and one question I have is sometimes in Christian culture today, we kind of have this concept of redeeming. And what we like to do, Christianity likes to redeem things and claim it for itself. Is this another example of Christians just simply kind of taking something from the culture and saying, well, I'm going to take that word back and I'm going to make it better? Or is this more of just like, as kind of Michael was saying in a way, but like, this is just the integration of these pieces or of this language into something, some sort of nomenclature that we understand. And yet the Christian community is becoming a part of it. How would you slice that? Or would you put it a different way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I think when, I mean, I guess there's two ways to talk about redemption, right? One is appropriation so that nobody else can use that term, becomes our distinctive. And the other way is redeeming it in the sense of the fullness of what that term has meant hasn't yet come to the fore until Christ enters that picture. And I think really that's what, and I'll just keep saying Paul, because I argue that Paul's the only one in early Christianity who actually named his communities ecclesia, that communities associated with the Jerusalem apostles did not name themselves ecclesia. So there was no church in the sense of a universal term applied to all Christians in the first century that grew. But with ecclesia, yeah, I'd say I would analogize it maybe to what Paul did in Acts 17 in Athens, where he sees this unknown God altar and he says, wait a second, there's the witness, there's God's fingerprint already in the culture. I'm going to start there to show them that God's always been in their culture. They just didn't know who he was. And I'm going to give them the fullness of who God is by ending up by talking about Christ. And so he's, you know, beautifully starts with this unknown God, and then he starts quoting their own poets and prophets to just, you know, support the biblical witness who God is. And then he ends up by talking about this guy who is raised from the dead, never names Jesus. And in a way, he's drawn his audience as far as he can until they have to make a decision. And ecclesia would be something similar. There's this term there, and Paul's going, wait a second. This is exactly so perfect about who we are as the people of God. And he takes that democratic impulse, he brings it into his communities. And so a lot of what the ecclesia did in the civic, in the city sense, his communities were going. But more so because in the Greek ecclesia, only males could be citizens, and generally of a more the richer version. But in his communities, everybody was a citizen of the ecclesia, and everybody had equal voice, women, slaves, poor, rich. So he democratized the conversation and said, we're all socially equal. We have a different stratum. You know, you're elite, rich. Yeah, I'm a slave. We don't change that, but we change our social standing with each other. So we're equal and peers. And I think that's brilliant what Paul did in not only redeeming the word ecclesia in that sense, but adding a whole other level of what it meant to be a part of a fully functioning ecclesia in Christ.
I don't want to say push back. I want to say what we see Paul doing is Paul reflecting what he sees Christ has done. So he's living out that common ground nature. But it's not so much Paul, the ingenious one. He happens to be the first one to do it, but you're not saying that Paul invented this new way that the church exists as if what he has come up with stands apart from what Jesus has already taught, but is more of a continuation. Is that, am I touching rightly on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think what Paul is doing, he's naturally extending the teaching of Jesus. I mean, the thing with Paul is he never actually mentions the teaching of Jesus. You know, maybe, you know, once, like he says, where the Lord didn't say this, but I say about, you know, women and divorce and stuff. But he's extending naturally Christ's teaching, because Jesus didn't talk so much about Gentiles. I mean, there were elements, Syrophoenician women or whatever, but that wasn't the focus of his ministry teaching. And Paul's extending it now into the Gentile world and saying, here's the continuity from Christ into my Gentile mission, so that we're all understanding what it means to be community of God in that
way. Paul seemed to really contextualize, the message and mission of Jesus seems, you know, really within the context in which he was going. And it seems like what I'm hearing from you, Ralph, is that the use of ecclesia and almost the reimagination of it from this social structure that really created it out of society, he's kind of reimagining it as this more holistic people group that is, of course, bound together in Christ. Is there any relationship, because you were mentioning also the Jewish people, and we have to kind of go back to the Old Testament, but is there any sort of relationship or line that you've drawn from maybe passages such as what comes to mind is Jeremiah 29, where Israel's in exile and Jeremiah gets this word, to send it back to those who are in exile in Babylon, build houses. You've been sent in exile, build houses, live in them, plant gardens, eat their produce, take wives, have sons. And then verse 7, but seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare, you will find your welfare. Is there any sort of connection point there? Because some of the things I think you were saying sound really familiar to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say conceptually, yeah, there's a lot of connection points. I don't know that Paul specifically references that or alludes to that particular passage. But conceptually, I think all of those elements are part of what it meant to be an ecclesia. Like he's saying, these are your urban contexts, and you just need to partner with your urban context, but add Christ into the mix to just really fulfill what all of these urban contexts were hoping for in terms of, functioning, healthy community. And to challenge, I mean, the big word is oligarchs. So, I mean, in the first century, the cities weren't independent, self-ruling, like, say, in 4th century, B.C., in Athens, whatever. You know, you had the Roman Empire, and the Romans deputized oligarchs or, super rich elites to oversee certain regions of the city. They also had governors. And so you had this hierarchical social injustice happening, that the ecclesia is to be a witness that, you don't have to do life in this hierarchy where you're nobody is totally equal. We can do life in Christ where everybody is an equal citizen of the kingdom And challenge is, how do we live that out? Corinth was having a lot of problems with that, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ralph, then a quick follow-up then, but like, are we to believe that the church, in its, according to Paul, the ecclesia, is it designed and meant to replace the social governing structures of its time? Or is it meant to coexist or something else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, not to replace. I mean, there are some who would suggest that, not even necessarily that Paul meant it, but by using political terminology, that he's planted the seeds that future generations built on and then eventually tried to create, you know, the kingdom of God on earth as an actual political, social, institutional movement that was counter to the non-Christian sort of forces. But for Paul, I don't see him anywhere indicating that was any agenda he had. And he said, pray for those in governance. So he said, come alongside and don't willfully challenge the civic governance that's in place, because they're for your health and benefit. But I'd suggest that, you know, these, and for the Christians, I mean, they weren't unique in how they gathered, because, you know, anything about association, kind of sociology, so in the ancient world, starting with the 2nd century BC till the 3rd century CE, associations or common interest groups just exploded in the ancient world. So you had, you know, trade guilds where they'd gather together and create associations, neighborhood associations, God worshiping gods associations, funerary associations, banqueting societies, all this stuff developed. So how the Christians organized themselves was very familiar to any who would enter. They go, oh, we got this. You're just like an association. You're just like the neighborhood guys down the street here who are getting together because they're a book reading club. Well, you guys are not a book reading club. You are, you know, who's this Christ guy? What's the difference? And they, you know, their Christ was more than just this cultic association of rituals and all the stuff you do. It was a transformative, a life-giving, a community building, and reaching out into the neighborhoods to bring life into the neighborhood. So, I mean, it was something radical for that time.
Yeah, I love what you're saying, Ralph. When you're describing this sense of familiarity that the first century culture would have had with what the Christians were doing in their gathering, does that hint, I'm leading you here, hoping that you're going to agree with me, doesn't that hint at the adaptive nature of the Christian community, that they could meet as ecclesia, they could meet as voluntary association, vocational association, neighborhood association, or what have you? And there would be some resonance there in terms of the way in which the community interacted with each other and so on.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge to us as churches today. I mean, we've built purpose-built structures separate from our sometimes, you know, neighborhood communities. We have a particular way of what church looks like, how we do things that doesn't really resonate with our culture anymore. And I think that's a challenge. That even post-COVID, we've been forced to really rethink what does it mean to be the church and to, quote, do church. And I think that's been a healthy thing. We've had to rethink who are we and how do we live in this world. But I think a big thing is we just need to also think about, well, you know, I guess if you think of retail sales, the customer is the one you're trying to always make sure you're adapting for. And so I think we've lost sight of our customers at times. And said, our customers have to come through our entryway and use our terminology and figure out our ways of signing them on how to get into the innerness of who we are, rather than creating ways in which we're familiar, like ancient associations. Christians were familiar in many respects of how they did life, of what they're doing, but they did it so much at such a higher level of community that people went, whoa. This is transformative. So I think that there's a real challenge for us.
I think you're being too kind to the church today. I think we do a horrible job of making new and inventive ways to make Christianese the thing that we wield like a weapon. And it is utilized by some of the most well-meaning people, the true Jesus followers. Like, I'm not trying to say that people who speak in Christianese don't now love Jesus and they're only concerned about themselves. I'm not saying that. However, there is an unintentional back end to doing this in which the Christianese gets spoken and it creates more of an us versus them. And the people who don't know the Christianese can only feel like outsiders. And the people who know Christianese feel like insiders. And then we gear everything that we have to those who are already on the inside to keep them happy without, like you're saying, looking outside of ourselves and saying, how do we actually care for the outside? How do we actually, I don't want to say consumer, but how do we actually look for the people who are not in the in group and bless them? And you said it earlier, I have my nice little HCPN notebook for notes, because you said earlier, I was like, man, how does my church bring life to our community? Like, that should always be a guiding principle. How are we actually showing up and bringing life to the people who are around us? Because if we aren't asking that, then we're just trying to entertain and speak in Christianese. And I'm getting a little fiery, but I appreciate what you're bringing up.
I'm glad you got fired about this. That I mean, we exist for the world, not for ourselves, right? The ecclesia in the ancient world existed for its world, for the city, not for the members. They were there to think broadly. And yeah, how do we bring life outside of our walls? And I think that's crucial, just vital.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all downhill from there. That was the best. Yes. Amen.
That was the line of the pod right there. Ralph coined it. He got it. He won. Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, there are a number of things that are swarming around in my head, and I know we can go many different directions here, but I think we can't lose sight of the fact that what you were saying, Andrew, about this Christianese, how in the first century, Paul's using the language of the time, right? He's not making up words necessarily and Christianizing his language, but he's using the words of the culture. Because those are words that the culture understood. And in this sense, it seems to me, and of course, this is what we've been talking about continuously on the podcast, is how adaptive the early church was and how important it is for us to rediscover how we too today should be adaptive and kind of move away from these monolithic forms that we're so familiar with, so that we can connect, Ralph, like what you were saying, with people in our communities.
I think, Michael, one of the things you're touching on again is, I don't mean to speak ill of the blue hairs, it's that there are so many people who are a part of a past generation of the church who actually did adaptive ecclesiology well in their time, and there were forms, and there was verbiage, yes, those are two different words, that they would utilize, and they did for a while, and it was awesome then, and it absolutely landed as it should have in a past culture. But there is sometimes a hesitancy to change so that we can actually reach the people, the world, who doesn't yet know Jesus, because we have our hands gripped so tightly on what we are used to, and it's that past term. Instead of saying, just like our forefathers, foremothers, just like the people who preceded us in the church utilized terms even 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, to make inroads with the people who are around them, we shouldn't be afraid to do the same thing. Not because we're trying to buck a system, not because we're trying to be cool or stand out or stand apart, but to actually reach those who don't yet know him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. Totally.
It seems like, Ralph, even just in this conversation, we're like going back to what you kind of began with, and that is what ecclesia was to the culture and society. And I just kind of want to continue to piggyback off of the conversations and the comments we've just been making, but that is the church seemed to have adopted a social function, a social understanding of how it was beginning to organize and gather itself, and then kind of adapt itself to, I wouldn't say conform, but utilize those kind of functions and how it was gathering, how it was discussing, how it was solving issues, and then bringing this other component of the spiritual side, the Christness, right, a greater vision, into that form, and kind of creating this new community, this freshness, that seemed to feel more fulfilling and perhaps even better than what was already there. Is that some of the implications we should take away from in terms of if Paul was creating a more just space through the life and witness of Christ, but also through the Spirit in these spaces? Is that what we should be taking away from here? Is maybe the church is in a season in which it must readapt and do the same and do likewise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think even it's a really good direction to be thinking, because even as we think about maybe let's go back to what does ecclesia mean, that helps us adapt and understand what is the irreducible minimal priority we must always have in mind as the ecclesia. So because we call ourselves church, we actually miss the essence of what ecclesia meant. And so the ecclesia, and when you translate it, it just means assembly. So if whenever you see the word ecclesia, its base meaning is assembly, meeting, gathering. There wasn't always just an official in the city formal gathering. Sometimes in Greek literature, when generals gathered their troops, they called an ecclesia just to communicate. But anyway, the idea is this gathering of people for a common purpose together. That's the essence. When we use the word church, we add different concepts in that allow us to give priorities to things that get away from the ecclesia. For example, church means building. So when we, you know, get together Sundays, I refuse to say to my kids when they're younger, we're going to church. I said, we're going to go meet with the church. Because saying going to the church means we're going to a building. So the church is not a building. Mm-hmm. Ecclesia never meant building in the ancient world. Ecclesia also never meant a religious organization. Now we use it for a religious organization. You know, Baptist church, Catholic church, Anglican church is this religious organization element. That's not the priority. So when we think of, you know, church and people think, oh, it's a religious organization. We have to maintain the denomination. We have to maintain our particular distinctives. It's like, oh man, you know, we major on the minors. Let's major on Christ. That's what unites us. Give us freedom to have diversity within the body. Or like Paul says, you know, some people, churches are hands, some are eyeballs. Don't compete with each other. Complement, work together for the unity of the body. But ecclesia, in its essence, if it means gathering, people coming together for common purposes of gathering, then it's all about community. And at any, I would say, as churches, we need to always look at how are we preventing community from happening by how we are doing church, how we are being the church. And it's not just community for Christians. How are we building community? Because God, wherever God is, well, I'd say this, wherever community is, God is there. Because the devil refuses to build community. When you find community building in your communities, breathe life into that. Come alongside people who have common gardens, because that's a community building thing. Let's resource that. Come alongside, you know, community groups in your neighborhoods and see how can we help bring life to that. I think that's the key. How do we bring life, community, that ecclesia was trying to do? And so whatever we are as a church, as a congregation, any decisions we make must always say, how is this helping or hindering community? If it's hindering, it might be very good, but it's probably not the best thing we can be doing.
Ralph, what I don't hear.
Say, actually, sir, one other thing. And ecclesia does not mean called out ones.
I just wanted to say that.
I was just going
to
go there.
Ralph, what does it not mean? And I knew you exactly. were going to say that, so thank you.
We're all going there. Explain that more, please.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's something in grammatical circles that's called a root fallacy. And so when you take a word, a Greek word, and ekklesia, people say, well, it has the preposition ek, E-K in front, and then it has klesia, K-L-E-S-I-A, afterwards. And if you break those apart, ek means out of, klesia means called ones. So called out ones, that's what ekklesia meant. Very bad grammar. Because a word, a compound word has a meaning that's not necessarily the sum of the two parts. It can mean something totally different than the sum of the two parts. It has meaning and context. So words have meaning in how they're used in the time they're being used. So when Paul's using ekklesia in the first century, we have to use the meaning of ekklesia in the first century. And ekklesia as two different words called out ones was never, ever the meaning, even when it was first begun in the 6th century BC. That's very bad grammatical.
Have we figured out who screwed it up first? Like, so that we can just really point fingers?
Yeah.
Who knows?
So, maybe somebody but Ralph, that, go. Yeah, go ahead.
That's so important to hear because it actually bridges into my quick question as a follow-up. But what I'm not hearing you say, and this is now implied, but I'm not hearing you say the church is to be separate from the world, right. Which there is a strong movement for the church to be something in completely alternative to society. And so that's not what I'm hearing you say. That's not what I'm hearing you, the sum of your research is. So maybe you could speak to that as to why that, I mean, you've been building the case here, but what are the potential pitfalls or harms that if the church were to believe that we are the called out ones and maybe we make that jump to say we are to be out of this world, right? In it, but not out, but not of it. Right, is another way to say it. What are the potential pitfalls of the church embodying that version of ekklesia and not the one that you've been articulating and arguing for?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some different metaphors. well, one thing is we then will tend to focus only on spiritual priorities for what we're doing as the body of Christ. So we're going to separate from any cultural involvements, any political involvement. And when I say political, I'm not talking federal level or even provincial or state level. I'm talking municipal level. That's the level at which Christians were engaging politics per se, right? So that's the level we should prioritize as churches, is how can we get involved in the politics of our municipalities, towns, villages.
Police.
Polis. Yeah, P-O-L-I-S is the Greek word for city-state. Politics came from. So how do we get into the polis, not remove ourselves from any priorities that the polis has? So I think that's one thing, is we just become spiritual bodies, but we have no practical value in the world around us in demonstrating Christ and incarnating Christ in the world around us. The other thing is we then get a fortress mentality. We're the called out ones. Okay, build the fort, create the walls, close the gates. We don't want to be contaminated by the world. And so we get our little fortresses and we create our empires. And instead of being kingdom people, we become empire builders. Instead of kingdom builders, empire builders. And wherever God is, that's where the kingdom is. And God's out there in the world, and we're in our little walls and our little huddles, and God's saying, "Hello, you want to come join me?" You know, that's for me. That's some of the downsides of this called out ones kind of mentality. I mean, the positive is, yes, we are called out from engaging in the love of the world and the things of the world. But we're not to be separated in our engagement with the world, just separate in how we demonstrate the heavenly world in our earthly worlds. Always a challenge.
So good. Yeah, so good.
So
yeah.
we don't want to take the Benedictine option? Is that, do we not want to write a compendium book already of that name and then live an existence like a monk culture where we are separating ourselves from others? That would be what you would not advise?
I'd say that's very unhealthy.
It's been floated.
It's been popularized.
That's right. This is so important, Ralph, for us. And I think as those of us who are really, I think in the West for sure, as we are struggling with just really a cultural and social transformation that's occurring, and the church is really struggling to find its place in this world. I think there's important lessons here to glean from this. There's a lot of ideas out there, but also too, an area that I'm very passionate about that you're, of course, like reintegrating and showing us why it is so critical. But the concept of doing justice in society is the bedrock of what Christianity has been about and does. And it does so not in alignment with its political powers or wills or temperaments of the day, but rather because it is truly baked into the goodness of God and the work of the Holy Spirit and our radical love for self, neighbor, and for Him. And you're just demonstrating by showing that the church used the systems, the orchestrations, the gatherings of the day, the elements, the tools of the day to fulfill that work. And dare I say, maybe that church, that is what has been lost. In our time is we have lost sight of even that particular work. And I think that's simple. I think the implications are huge across the world as well, as we are looking to plant churches and fulfill that mission and go forth and to share the gospel in other spaces as well. So this is such an enthralling conversation, and I so appreciate your research.
You're just a little excited there, Matt.
No, this is just normal Matt right now.
Yeah. He's actually pretty calm.
But I'm love having like-minded, somebody who Ralph, it's such a great conversation, and I appreciate your work on this particular thought as well.
Okay.
Dr. Corner, I think it would be wise if we shelve the ideas around pastor, scholar, theologian. And we come back and we invite you back on the podcast for kind of a part two, because I don't want us to try to add to the weight of the joy that we have had. And we'll put baby in the corner, and then we'll talk about that at a later time. Ralph, if people do want to engage with you on some of the things that we've talked about, or learn more about you through your works, where can they get in contact with you? Or how?
Yeah, I mean, they're free to email me. So my email is just my name, ralph.corner, K-O-R-N-E-R, then at, and then Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R. I'm part of Taylor Seminary, so T-A-Y-L-O-R, and then a hyphen, and then edu for education.ca. So ralph.corner@taylor-edu.ca.
That is excellent. Well, Ralph, thank you so very much for your time. I know that my brain is already spinning on some of these ideas,
Andrew, are you not preaching a sermon on Romans 13 this week? Is this going to suddenly change some of your thinking on how we submit to governing authorities?
The best part is I just preached on the end of Romans chapter 12, and may or may not have stirred a few pots about what does actually love and a pursuit of peace look like. And I may have jostled some things that certain people hold dear. And so what I do is I am what a good pastor does is he gives his friends the next week of preaching so that they have to deal with the really problem passages. So my buddy is doing Romans 13, but I, in no joke, Matt, I have already been like, okay, we probably won't have this podcast ready to post, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to send the audio to my friend so that he can listen to it while he does his prep for Romans 13, because I think it is so critical.
I'm thinking the same thing. I was thinking of you.
Going to be great. So Ralph, truly, thank you for impacting West Village Church and where we're going. But thank you for joining us today. Listeners, I hope that was a blessing to you. I can speak for Matt, Michael, and I, who have been nodding our heads the whole time. It's been a blessing to us. If there are more things that you want to continue to glean from the Ephesiology podcast, go to wherever your pod loader is and see who we have had. Either there is a guest or a topic that might interest you. We hope that it can serve you and be an encouragement to you. Or if you see that we have been scratching the idea around theological education, we've been doing more than scratching. Go to masterclasses.ephesiology.com. Learn more about what we have to offer through Kairos University and all of the fun of where God is taking us. For Matt, for Michael, for Ralph, and myself, thank you for doing theology and community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.